During the first hour, we replayed a conversation with Stanley Williams, which we had about a year ago. He is a professor of volcanology at Arizona State University. He survived Galeras, the eruption of a volcano in South America, in Colombia, and you heard about that. We talk now with Simon Winchester, who's live and very much in our studio, and is a celebrated British author who does nonfiction of every possible variety. I imagine you've got a novel or two secretly hidden away, haven't you?
Oh, I tried, but it was appalling. I wrote a book called Pacific Nightmare, which came out about 10 years ago, and it was utterly and completely dismal. So can we not talk about this, please?
That's the last we will say about Pacific Nightmare. What was the title again? Pacific Nightmare.
I can't remember.
Pacific Nightmare.
I cannot remember.
The new book, lots of our listeners will remember two recent books, which are 17th and 18th, probably in line in the oeuvre of Simon Winchester, by title The Professor and the Madman, which is about an interesting pair who got together in the making of the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, and the map that changed the world, even more recent, I think. And now a book that is widely celebrated already and very, very strongly and favorably reviewed just this last Sunday in the Sunday book section of the New York Times. The book in question, Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded. And that date was
the 27th of August, 1883, at 2 minutes past 10 in the morning.
Rather a long time ago. Why should we care?
Because it in all sorts of ways changed the world. And I think as we're talking on this medium, it did terrible things. It killed a lot of people. It changed the weather. It was an enormous noise, all that kind of thing. But one of the ways that I find it most interesting, it was the first major catastrophe in the world's history that happened after the invention of the submarine telegraph cable. And so while it took 12 days for the news of Lincoln's assassination to be read in the newspapers in London, the eruption of Krakatoa, the telegraph carried with Morse code news about the eruption to Batavia, the capital of what was then the Dutch East Indies, under the sea, using this new technology, to Singapore, under the sea again to Madras and Colombo, under the sea again up the Red Sea, through the Suez Canal, across to Malta, across to Gibraltar, under the sea again, under the Bay of Biscay, to Cornwall, to Cape Race, to Boston. It was published in the Boston Globe 4 hours after the eruption. So the world was a very big place before Krakatoa, but thanks to the submarine telegraph cable, a very much smaller place afterwards. And it was the beginning, if you like, of the global village, I like to think.
And if you lived in Boston, or if you lived in London, for that matter, or in Chicago, evidence of the volcanic eruption would reach you only a little while later.
Indeed, and I was in a museum in the middle of Kansas not long ago, and there was a test tube filled with what they claimed was Krakatoan dust, which had fallen onto a roof of a school there in the 1880s. No, the 6 cubic miles, which was essentially all of Krakatoa Island, was blasted, first of all, 25 miles up into the upper atmosphere. And the dust, the lighter dust, still remained in the upper atmosphere for a long, long time. And among other things, it changed the sunsets. And so for months afterwards, there were these incredibly vivid sunsets seen all over the world. So in places like Poughkeepsie, New York, for instance, the fire department was scrambled to put out fires that the spotters thought they had seen in the western suburbs, but in fact there were no fires at all. It was these incredibly vivid sunsets.
Years ago, Carl Sagan, not so many years ago, but Carl Sagan, before the Cold War ended, was very worried about the possibility of nuclear warfare, and he got involved in arguing against the piling up of more and more nuclear weapons and calling for nuclear disarmament. And he developed, together with a Russian colleague, a scenario which they labeled nuclear winter. That is to say, the nuclear weapons, if exploded, would produce so much dust up in the air for so long that they would essentially block off sunlight, thus killing crops and producing a great ecological catastrophe, even if you weren't radiologically poisoned instantly by the nuclear weapons. And the nearest equivalent he could find to anything like that had already happened in human experience was Krakatoa.
Well, indeed, although it has to be fair, the Krakatoa eruption was almighty, and it lowered the world's ambient temperature by about a Fahrenheit degree. But in 1815, oddly enough, another Indonesian volcano called Tambora exploded. It killed far fewer people, and there were far fewer people around to record what has happened, which is why we don't know much about it. But it lowered the world's ambient temperature by a centigrade degree, and the following year, 1816, was known in America as the year without summer. Mm. There was snowfall in Washington, D.C. in July, for instance, and it had the effect of causing Irish people who had already emigrated from Ireland because, you know, no potatoes and they were miserable, come to the east of the United States. They found the weather there was much worse than they had expected, and most of them went back again. Or else they went on to California. A lot of Northern California Irish families were recorded as having arrived in California in 1816. The reason they went there is because of a volcano in Java 100 years before.
If the butterfly flaps its wings in China, that will produce effects all over the world, we're told in a famous scenario which has never been tested, but might as well take it seriously. Surely, if a great volcano erupts, there are consequences not merely for weather, not merely in terms of death, not merely in the production of tsunami tidal waves, which can kill thousands, as was the case after the Krakatoa eruption, but there are all sorts of incalculable other consequences. They're calculable after the fact, but you couldn't have predicted them before. I learned from your book that the spread of Islam as a religion can, in fact, in large part, be attributed to the eruption of Krakatoa. That will need explanation, as will a great deal else. But now we pause and go to the newsroom and for a quick update from Judy Pilak. And we return to Simon Winchester, whose new book, Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded, August 27, 1883, is just published by
HarperCollins.
By HarperCollins. I'm looking at the spine.
Yes, indeed.
I can't find HarperCollins. Now I find them. I just mentioned one interesting effect that's sort of out of order, out of sequence, but all the same, having raised it, I have to ask you to explain it. What does all of this have to do with the spread of Islam?
Well, I'll try and keep it fairly brief, but basically, in the 17th and 18th centuries, Java and Sumatra, the two big islands in the western part of what is now Indonesia, what was then the Dutch East Indies, were very fertile ground for missionaries. Initially, they had been animists, the people of that part of the world. Then Hindu missionaries from India, which after all isn't too far away, had converted essentially most of the country to Hinduism. The only relic of Hinduism now is the island of Bali, which is steadfastly Hindu. But come the middle of the 18th century, Arab Muslim missionaries fanned out from Arabia specifically, bent on converting these people to the greater delights of Islam. And it was a very, very successful campaign, so that by the middle of the 19th century, one could say that most Javanese and most Sumatrans were Islamic, or at least were on teetering on the brink of becoming Islamic. So 1883, this volcano explodes catastrophically and kills 37,000 people and causes all manner of mayhem. Very cleverly, very shrewdly, the mullahs, particularly a man, a haji, called Abdul Karim, said once the dust had literally settled, that this was a sign from Allah, a sign that the Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah, was going to come down. And he was extremely angry. And he was angry because the craven Javanese had allowed themselves to be ruled by white Western Dutch colonialists. Rise up, he said, and kill them. And so, 6 weeks after the eruption of Krakatoa, there were several incidents where young Javanese men with beards and with long white robes, with the Quran in one hand, either actually or metaphorically, and with scimitars in the other hand, attacked Dutch soldiers. None of them was killed, but they were fairly badly injured. This prompted Abdul Karim to say, no, let's do this in a more organized way. Krakatoa is the signal that Allah is displeased. But you can't just kill people wantonly like this, you've got to do it in an organized fashion. So they sat down and planned a campaign which finally broke out in 1888, known as the Great Banten Rebellion. And this resulted in lots of Dutch soldiers and bureaucrats and commercial people and their wives and children being slaughtered in the name of militant Islam by these young Javanese men. Well, the Dutch reacted, much as Tommy Franks and his men have reacted today, by sending in a large army and putting the rebellion down. But it was the beginning of the end for Dutch rule in that part of the world, and it was also the first modern eruption, it doesn't need to be a pun, of Islamic militancy, targeting specifically white Western Christian infidels, if you like, in modern times. I mean, we tend to think, don't we, that all this that's going on in the modern world derives from Palestine and the Middle East. Well, not at all. There was Ethiopia, the whole business of, you know, Gordon of Khartoum, which is a similar dealing with...
with another claimant to be the Mahdi, yeah. Actually.
And then these Javanese. And the final irony of it all, or synchronicity, if you like, is that the organizers, people like Abdul Karim, came from that southern part of Saudi Arabia, the Hadramaut, the modern Yemen, which is precisely where Osama bin Laden comes from today. So it would have been irresponsible to have written a chapter in this book saying that Krakatoa is a sort of lineal antecedent of the events of the last couple of years. But at least it's sort of intellectually interesting to note that the parallels between the two events and to remember that the origins of modern Islamic militancy go back a lot further than the founding of the
Soviet Union. And Indonesia now has the largest Muslim population of any country in the world. You would really argue in a what-if way that if Krakatoa hadn't erupted, Indonesia wouldn't be as Muslim as it now is.
I wonder. I mean, I think they were converting very aggressively. I mean, Islam is, after all, an Arab proselytizing religion.
Yeah.
And it needs converts, and they were brilliantly successful. So they went at it in a very organized, clever way, whereas the Hindus, typical Hindu, they'd gone at it in a sort of informal, rather more gentle way.
Now, you start this book with a visit to Krakatoa. I didn't know there was anything left there in the sea at all, but apparently there's some place where you can put down and take a look. And you had been there 25 years earlier when there was nothing, essentially. And you come back 25 years later, and what do you discover?
Well, this entity, there was nothing. I mean, the island was completely or essentially completely annihilated. But in the 1930s, fishermen who were casting their nets in the sea over where Krakatoa once had stood were terrified to see huge columns of flame coming out of the sea itself. And after a week or so of this, a thin layer of black volcanic sand was seen above the surface of the water. Well, it was washed away, but it came back. That was washed away. It came back for a third time, and this time it stayed. And a new piece of real estate was created. And the Javanese gave it the name Anak Krakatoa, which means the child of Krakatoa. And that, when I first saw it in 1974, was a respectable little conical volcano, a little island in the sea, about 1,000 feet high. But when I saw it again in 1999, so 25 years later, I was sort of puzzled because it seemed to be a lot bigger. And I took some photographs of it and compared, when I got back to where I was living then in Hong Kong, compared the newer photographs with the older ones, and it was significantly bigger. So I rang the Indonesian hydrographic people and said, what's the height of contemporary Anak Krakatoa? And it was just over 500 feet taller than it had been 25
years
ago.
So it's coming back, and it plans to assert itself again, I suppose.
Well, it's coming back, and it's asserting itself every day, and that's actually a good sign, because the volcanoes that are really dangerous are the ones that are not erupting, that are building up enormous pressures within them. Anak Krakatoa, I should say, is relieving its pressure almost every day.
Is it then the case that there's no such thing as a dead volcano?
Oh, there are dead. I mean, there are three things. There are extinct volcanoes, there are dormant volcanoes, and there are active volcanoes. Extinct volcanoes we can forget about. The hot spot or whatever that causes the volcanicity has moved on to somewhere else. The dormant ones are the most dangerous, and indeed the granddaddy of all volcanoes to come in the world is in the United States. It's under Yellowstone. When that goes off, it is going to make all these others, Tambora, Toba, which is the world's biggest, and Krakatoa, pale in
But you say it's under Yellowstone. It hasn't yet broken the surface.
It hasn't broken the surface. It gives indications, like Old Faithful. But it is a huge and very
And all those other bubbly ponds.
All the bubbly ponds, yeah. But I think it's safe to say that, well, one hopes it's safe to say, that we will probably be extinct long before that erupts.
The geological prediction is what? How many years before
maybe
a volcano rises and ultimately erupts?
Maybe quarter of a million. It'll probably be years, and it'll destroy this country almost totally.
The whole country?
Certainly the West will break away, which is what some people think ought to happen anyway. But yes, it'll spread its effects certainly as far as Chicago.
It happens.
Probably further. Nothing to worry about. No, don't lose any
Well, it's a little bit more of a worry than the fellow I had here some years ago who had a book about the coming ice age and who said that, gave a little homely prediction saying that Chicago will be covered by 3 miles of ice in some 15 million years. As it happens, my brother is a specialist in climatology, and I called him the next day and asked him about it. He said, oh, he's got it all wrong. I said, well, I'm glad to hear that. He said, yes, it's more likely to be in about 5,000 years.
Oh, really?
But that will happen before the eruption of the Yellowstone volcano, then.
Yes, I think so. You'll first get ice in Chicago, and then you'll get destroyed by the Yellowstone volcano.
What is a volcano? How does it fit in the overall ecology of the Earth?
Well, basically, volcanoes are very good. I mean, it's because they breathe into the air an atmospheric mix that is actually very useful for life. I mean, it's a classic regenerative thing. To have the right number of volcanoes, and the Earth is the only body in the solar system that has volcanoes, except for one of, I think it's Jupiter's moons, Io, I think.
Because if we didn't have heat at the center, we wouldn't have a livable Earth, would we?
Well, that's precisely the point. And if we didn't have volcanoes, we wouldn't have much of an atmosphere either, because that is spewing out water and steam and carbon dioxide, which, of course, the trees need. So it spews out vital elements. I mean, it does so in a very violent and dangerous way. But to have the right number of volcanoes is part of the magic of why this Earth is a livable planet.
But they occur because of shifts in the tectonic plates, basically, don't they?
Yes. I mean, that was really what drew me to this subject, because I thought it was beautiful and exotic and fascinating, but when I looked up in the bibliography, the last book that had been written about Krakatoa was written in 1965. And in 1965, we had not the foggiest idea why volcanoes erupted. We knew where they were. We knew what they had done and what they did and what they were likely to do. But we didn't know why they did it. Why, for instance, there is no volcano in Chicago and never will be. And why there are heaps of volcanoes in Sumatra and Java and in the mountains in the west in the United States and in Peru and in Chile, in Iceland, in Hawaii.
What's the simple answer to that question? Why don't we have them in Chicago?
The simple answer is that Chicago is in the middle of a tectonic plate. Volcanoes are generally caused either where tectonic plates are moving apart from one another and allowing the convected material in the center of the Earth to spill out, or, more significantly, for dangerous volcanoes, where two tectonic plates hit each other, and that's exactly what's happening in Sumatra and Java.
A tectonic movement also has a good deal to do with earthquakes, hasn't it?
It does. I mean, for instance, the Pacific plate and the North American plate slide past each other in Northern California, and that's why these great shears, strains build up, which occasionally shift and cause, like, the eruption of, beg your pardon, the earthquake that destroyed San Francisco in 1906.
This knowledge is not a late acquisition for you. As I understand it, your university training was in geology, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it's somewhat laughable. I mean, I took a degree in geology in 1966, but it was a degree that was really lamentable. It was given it has a name in England. The degree I got was called a Desmond, and they call them Desmonds, one of those rather pathetic English jokes. It's a play on the word Desmond Tutu. African. So I got a Tutu, which is a second-class degree in a second tier. So armed with a Desmond, I could only become a journalist.
Does the bishop know that they...
He does. He's terribly proud, and he did not get a Desmond himself. He got a first.
I'm sure he deserved one.
Yes.
We have some commercials coming. And when we return, let's go back to the fatal date and the ensuing weeks, months, and years. that followed. August 27th, 1883, as things blow up. We'll be right back to Simon Winchester, author of Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded. That's just published by HarperCollins. And back to Simon Winchester, drawing from his new book, Krakatoa. That's K-R-A-K-A-T-O-A, Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded, August 27, 1883. HarperCollins, the publishers. Well, let's go to that day. Were there premonitory signs, or did the dawn come up quietly and gracefully on that day?
No, the dawn did not come up quietly and gracefully. It had essentially been grumbling away since the middle of May. No one had any idea that it was going to behave as catastrophically as it did. But since May, it had been sending up columns of fire and smoke, and it had been very noisy. And the people who lived in what was then Batavia, which is now Jakarta, the Dutch would complain that listening to chamber concerts, which they liked to do, because it was a very elegant city. It was the Paris of the East or the Venice of the East. They complained that it was often impossible to hear the finer points of the music because of the thundering of the volcano.
How far away is Krakatoa?
Almost exactly 100 miles.
Only 100 miles.
Only 100 from Batavia.
From Batavia.
Yeah. However, come that morning, Monday morning, 10:02, suddenly there were four incredible explosions, culminating in the true paroxysmal volcanic explosion a few seconds after 10:02, which annihilated the island. And that,
how many people were living on the island? Not many.
None, as a matter of fact.
None at all.
People, there used to be a prison colony there. That was really nice of the Dutch, who were not the kindest of colonial people. They had a prison there, but they had closed it long before. People would go there to gather wood, and there were some ginger trees and some pepper bushes. But the Javanese regarded it as, quite rightly and presciently, as it turned out, as a somewhat evil island. So there was no one on the island itself. So then at 10:02, it wiped itself out. And the first thing to say about it, really, was the sound. It was an incredible bang. I mean, a thunderclap like you could not imagine, which certainly is the loudest sound ever generated on the Earth since humankind has been on hand.
Heard how far away?
Well, heard, certainly recorded with no doubt at all that that's what it was, on Rodriguez Island, which was a British possession near Mauritius, which is 2,968 miles away, which, when you think about it, is the equivalent of a explosion in New York being heard clearly in San Francisco. So it was a very, very loud noise. So there was that, and then physically what appears to have happened is that 6 cubic miles of the island, because it was an island, vanished, annihilated in a matter of microseconds, hurled at least 25 miles into the sky. You can tell that from the radius at which large ejecta were found in the countryside around it. And for a few microseconds, a gigantic hole was carved in the sea, as it were. It sounds a rather bizarre concept. But a hole which at the bottom was red hot. And then, within a matter of seconds, trillions of tons of seawater collapsed into this hole, and because it was so hot, instantly flashed into steam, causing an enormous tidal wave, or tsunami, as we're supposed to call them these days. And these were the real killers. And they radiated outwards. There were four of them, as there were four explosions, but the cataclysmic one, and let's concentrate on the last and worst one. It at least was 136, possibly 145 feet high, moving outwards, both to the Sumatran shore and the west and the Javan shore and the east, at speeds of 200-300 miles an hour. So a frightening thing.
One can't really imagine that.
No one
can. When it comes
can't.
To the movement of water.
It is. It beggars belief. It really does. And yet, one of the wonderful things from a researcher's point of view about writing this book was that the colonials. I mean, what does a colonial do when he's sitting in the heat of a faraway place like Java? He drinks his Geneva, he goes to whatever job he's got, and he writes home. And so there are lots and lots of letters preserved still by the families that got them, which begin, you know, dear grandma in Utrecht or Leiden or Rotterdam or Amsterdam, you wouldn't believe what happened to me yesterday. And it's possible to find those, and people in Holland were so helpful and sent them to me or showed them to me. And I mean, there were sorts of stories. I mean, I love the one of it was a German, actually, not a Dutchman, who was standing on top of a building in a town called Merak, where there was a quarry that he was the supervisor of. And he was on the roof of a 20-foot-tall building, which itself was on the top of a 100-foot hill. It had been built there so that it commanded wonderful views over the strait towards Sumatra. He saw this enormous wave barreling down on top of him. It was much higher than him, so if he was 20 feet up on a building on a hill that was 100 feet tall, it must have been 130, 140 feet tall. It ripped the building off its foundations instantly and crushed it, but it picked him up and he surfed along with it. He assumed he was going to die, but he looked to his right. He's very careful to say it was on his right, and he saw being carried along on this great pile of green water a crocodile, and with the kind of presence of mind which one can only imagine a German to have, he decided, I might survive if I leap aboard this crocodile. So he did, and he dug his thumbs into its eye sockets, and he surfed on the top of this wave for fully 2 miles over the jungle, until finally the wave beached him and an extremely angry crocodile in the jungle, and he ran like billy-o and outran the crocodile and wrote a letter back to his grandmother in Holland saying, you're never going to believe this. I don't believe it, actually. But yeah,
I was about to say, it sounds a bit like the invention of Baron Munchausen.
There is a Munchausen-esque quality to it, and yet there are a lot of, not quite as lurid a report as that, but it was a terrifying event, and those who did survive it had very lurid stories to tell about it. So when you add it up, it's sort of jigsaw puzzle.
It must have destroyed the capital city completely.
No, it didn't get anywhere near the capital city.
Oh, it didn't go in that direction?
No, there was a huge wall of mountains, really, between the mountains. But it destroyed all the villages and towns nearby.
Some 40,000 were killed, you said?
Yes, just under 40,000 were killed. Most of them were killed by the agency of water, not by lava flows or, you know, rocks and things. But, it's the most... the volcano that has caused most fatalities in human history.
But one payoff was the most beautiful sunsets the world has ever known, apparently.
Stunning sunsets, and they lasted for many months. The dust and ash was carried by what we now know to be the jet stream, which in those days they were unaware of the existence of, and so this was one of the benefits of meteorology.
These were sunsets over the United States and over Europe. They weren't just down there in the Indies.
No, they were everywhere. They were a sort of spiral of effects, which you can chronicle. First were obviously near the equator where Krakatoa is, but then they spread north. They got as far north as Edmonton and Calgary, and then they sort of ebbed southwards, and then they moved into the southern hemisphere about a month later. But it prompted artists like Frederick Church, one of the great Hudson River School of artists, to paint beautiful, beautiful, and he was already known for his lurid pictures of Niagara and things like that. And he saw these sunsets and said, I've got to have a go at this, and produced some wonderful paintings.
When was it all over? What were the last effects of Krakatoa?
Well, in a funny sort of way, the effects are still being felt one way and another. I mean, still there's dust in the atmosphere, which is identifiable as Krakatoa.
Really?
But yes, but effectively, it was over about a year later. But certainly the suns and the blue moons and what we call the afterglow of the sunsets were visible until March or April the following year. And, of course, it took an awfully long time to repair the damage, and one might say that the effects on, you know, Islam and things like that were very, very long-lasting indeed. So Krakatoa had echoes much beyond the simple and terrifying event.
The human echoes are of great fascination. The influence upon Islamic diffusion is one that we've talked about, but there must have been other ways of adapting ideationally to all of this. What did the people of the Dutch Indies make of it all in coming years? How did it alter their way of life?
Well, things were happening in all sorts of strange ways. There was this, the Dutch were not, I say this, I believe, fairly neutrally, although I'm an Englishman and we had our empire too, but I think the Dutch were not good imperialists. I mean, you might argue that no empire is good, but some are better than others. The Dutch were at the fairly low end of the scale. They treated the Dutch East Indian citizens very badly. At about the time of the Krakatoa eruption, largely under the influence of a renegade civil servant called Edward Dekker, who wrote under the name Multatuli, and wrote a book called Max Havelaar, the Dutch were changing, were becoming, trying to become much more compassionate. Well, Krakatoa was an event which made them really pile the compassion on in a big way. And so not only did it come in incredibly swiftly, and they sent in warships with relief supplies and rebuild roads and railways and the infrastructure that had been wrecked by the water, but they gave them, to put it crudely, tax breaks and the kind of things which, I mean, they used to say that a fifth of the crop had to be, there were sort of complex rules. You weren't allowed to travel beyond a village without permission of the Dutch authorities. You had to tithe your income, so that the hugely swinging taxes, very strict rules on what you could and could not grow. These were relaxed in Western Java after Krakatoa, but it was too little too late, because the Muslims were on their case, and the Muslims were becoming very, very aggressive. And in the end, in 1950, of course, Dutch rule ended.
As we read about Krakatoa, and as you write about it, you're certainly aware of another great volcanic eruption to which it can be compared, both for similarities and for crucial differences. And that's an eruption a long, long time ago, over 2,000 years ago, of Vesuvius. And we have a record of what that was like from Pliny the Younger.
Pliny the Younger, who was, of course, killed by the eruption.
Pliny the Elder was killed.
His uncle. And indeed, the name Plinian is in his honor in the lexicon of volcanology, given to a volcano of absolutely cataclysmic proportions.
Was Vesuvius as big an eruption as Krakatoa?
No, Vesuvius wasn't anywhere near as big for a number of reasons. The nature of the rock, essentially the nature of the magma, made most European volcanoes, with the exception of Santorini, when you were talking about a volcano that was truly big, I mean, Pliny the Elder and a lot of other people in Pompeii, of course, died as a consequence of Vesuvius, but an entire civilization, the Minoan civilization, was essentially wiped out by the eruption of Santorini. And many argue that Santorini was actually a bigger volcano. You measure the equivalent of sort of danger of a volcano, the equivalent of the Richter scale, is called the VEI, the Volcanic Explosivity Index, which is a multiple of the amount of ejecta in cubic kilometers or miles multiplied by the height it's sent up into the atmosphere. So in the case of Krakatoa, it's 6 cubic miles of material sent 24 miles into the atmosphere. Of all the world's volcanoes, Toba, which was 250,000 years ago, also in North Sumatra, was massive. Then came Tambora, the one we were talking about earlier in 1815, Santorini, an Alaskan volcano, and then number 5 in the scale is Krakatoa. Vesuvius is below that, and Mount St. Helens, way, way down below that. Mount St. Helens was just a little popgun.
Is it?
One of Earth's more spectacular burps, but only a burp.
We are late for some commercials, but also it's time to invite telephone calls. Anything you'd like to ask or say or share about volcanoes, 591-7200 is the number. 591-7200, and the lines are open at this moment. If you're listening to us on the Internet at some great distance, including perhaps in Indonesia, and you want to get to us, the quick and easy way would be via email, the email address extension 720 as one word, extension 720, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. Extension 720 at Tribune.com or 591-7200. And we go directly to the phones for your questions and or comments to Simon Winchester, who is the author of Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded, August 27, 1883. And that's published by HarperCollins. 591-7200, the number. A moment ago, all the lines were taken. Now a few people have failed, or at least have not passed the muster. And so, once again, there are one or two lines available. If you want to reach us, move quickly, 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, thank you, Milton, and your guest as well. My question, to get right to the point, is simply this. Other than the historical value of volcanoes, what is the residual effect from the volcano in terms of how it affects the environment? And I know as pressures and temperatures differ, the results will differ as well. Does your guest have any insight onto that? Thank you very much. I'll take my call.
Well, it's a complex question. What I'm particularly interested in, and I hope it's not too tangential a way of answering it, is how did life, which had been completely extirpated on the part of the volcano that survived, this island called Rakata, and how did life on the new part of the volcano, the child of Krakatoa, how did it come back? And the two different situations. One, there was a part where fire and heat and dust and ash had completely obliterated life, and yet life came back. And on the other, the island that appeared out of the sea, there can never have been any life on that, and yet life arrived. And in the case of the first, and I don't want to bore everyone with this, but in the case of the first island, the zoologists went there and looked for life almost immediately after the eruption, as soon as things had cooled down, and they found nothing. But 6 weeks later, they did find something. And that first thing, that the beginnings of life, in other words, was a tiny little spider. And the wonderful thing about this spider was that it was an arachnid optimist. It was spinning a web, because it thought, one assumes if spiders think such things, that ultimately if it spun a web, a fly would come along and he would catch it and eat it. So the beginning of life, we're not quite so certain about how life, what the origin of life was on Anak Krakatoa, but certainly on Rakata, it was a spider. From then on, you got palm husks, coconut husks washing in on the shore, bringing seedlings, the beginnings of the forest. When I was last on Anak Krakatoa, I was not attacked by, but certainly startled by, an enormous monitor lizard, a 6-foot-long lizard, which lived there. So there are coconuts and birds and lizards and spiders, but the beginnings of it all was a spider. And the way that that got there, it was apparently that it had extended a skein of silk from its body and had drifted in the air like aeolian plankton and finally landed on the island. So the Earth, the system, has magical ways of restoring itself even after it's been so terribly wounded as it was by Krakatoa.
Of course, there is the great question of how life itself gets to the Earth, how life generates out of inorganic elements. But Francis Crick had a unique solution to that. He proposed some years ago in a book, having handled the DNA problem and so on, he proposed the panspermia hypothesis, that life doesn't originate on this planet. He kind of handles the problem of the origination of life by putting it off at one remove. It says it floated in from elsewhere.
From somewhere else. Exactly. And this wonderful man, Velikovsky, of course, would say that everything on the Earth came from Venus in the first place anyway.
Which doesn't really solve the problem. It just puts it off at a borrowed
place. Someone else would wait for a Venetian book to answer that.
591-7200, our number. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. My question is, we've heard the effects of the tsunami on the surrounding islands, but I'm also curious to know, if something like this had happened in the middle of a landmass or, you know, near a rift on the land, what kind of things could we expect in the future with an explosion this size? Could we have expected? You know, would we have had obviously greater loss of life, but would we have had an active volcano still today?
Well, oddly enough, the Tambora eruption of 1815 was in the middle of the land, and curiously, not as many people were killed, because there's two aspects to this story. volcanoes tend to produce very, very fertile soils on their flanks. And so people tend to go and live on the sides of volcanoes, even though they're very dangerous indeed. And you'll find in places like Mount Mayon in the Philippines, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, and the relics of Mount Tambora in Sumatra, lots and lots of villages. They get wiped out, and so lots of people die. The thing about Krakatoa, though, was that it produced this completely unexpected side effect of these gigantic waves, which killed a lot more people. Well, at the moment, there are two big volcanoes in the middle of Java, Merapi and Merbapu, which explode not as catastrophically as Krakatoa did, but pretty badly, and they kill a fair number of people. Sumatra and Java are very volcanic and very dangerous parts of the world, but because of these tsunamis, and also because there's no volcano very near a huge center of population like Yogyakarta or Jakarta itself, massive loss of life is not expected. But this one did cause massive loss of life because of these huge waves.
I thank you for your answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And we'll catch up with the commercial schedule. A quick stop for those. And then back to the phones, 591-7200. And if you'd rather reach us via email, that has, of course, infinite capacity, and it awaits you. The email address, extension 720@tribune.com. And speaking of the audio archives, as that last announcement just did, two new ones, that is, two programs recently done have just gone up on the archive. One is our conversation with Stephen Brill, who did the book about America in the aftermath of September 11. And then we also did, just a few weeks ago, a program focused on the work of a few people who've studied the archaeological findings suggesting that the tomb, or at least the ossuary, container for the bones of the brother of Jesus, James, or Jacob, have been found and have been identified. That has tremendous consequences for our Christological understanding of what happened in real history. And the program on the historical Jesus has just gone up. Coming up in a day or two, our recent conversation with Richard Schickel, the brilliant film critic and historian, and our program on the Chicago Outfit, that is the Chicago Mafia, but in this town they call it the Outfit, with John Drummond and with Gus Russo. 591-7200 is our number as we quickly go back to the phones. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm interested in knowing whether or not you're aware of the fact that there have been predictions for at least 100 years regarding upcoming earthquakes and volcanic activity here in the United States. And let me say very quickly, the Tambora earthquake of 1815 may or may not correlate with the largest earthquake we ever had back in 1811 in New Madrid, Missouri. But it was just found, I believe, in approximately 1985 by the government superimposing one satellite photograph over another that we have an earthquake fault line running down the very center of the United States. And a former scientist by the name of Gordon Michael Scallion, who has an organization I believe called Parallax Institute, has predicted that we're going to have, and somebody who track record in predicting earthquakes is very good in volcanic activity, predicts we're going to have a massive earthquake of over 8 coming out of New Madrid again very soon now.
Well, that's fascinating to me and alarming to many, I would have thought. I don't know very much, I confess, about what's going on here in the United States, but what they're doing in Java and Sumatra is largely being done in terms of volcanic eruptive prediction, is largely being done by Americans, and specifically by people from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, who have put hundreds of very small GPS transmitters on the flanks of all the volcanoes that interest them to see whether they are moving slightly. You'll remember that the northeast side of Mount St. Helens began to bulge very ominously before its eruption on the 18th of May 1980. Their feeling is if they look at how Java and Sumatra are themselves moving apart, as it were, around a big hinge, which has its fulcrum point around Krakatoa. This will at least give them some insight into the distortions which might well produce an eruption. But it's still, as you know only too well, and I don't know about the parallax that you're talking about just now, but that earthquake prediction and volcano prediction are still feels very much in their infancy. I think volcanic eruption prediction rather more accurate than earthquakes themselves.
You've never had either, or have you, had either earthquake or volcanic activity in the UK?
Oh, well, you might say that, I mean, most of Scotland is the result of, or northwest Scotland is the result of volcanic activity, and indeed where I have a small house on an island called Ling is just about 10 miles away from Mull, which is a huge volcanic centre.
The highlands of Scotland were thrown up by tectonic movement, so to speak.
Yes, it's
but
very...
But how long ago?
Oh, 250 million years ago, yeah. I mean, very, very long time ago. But Greenland, where I did, when I was a student geologist in 1965, I went there to do work, field work on the basalts, which were laid down a mere 30 million years ago. And we found from looking at the direction of the magnets, as it were, in the frozen hematite crystals, that Greenland had definitely moved 15 degrees to the west since those lavas were laid down, since the eruptions in East Greenland, and therefore there was no doubt at all that continental drift had happened. I mean, let's say, no, I'm being boring about it. That's a whole other story.
No, it's one of the most fascinating discoveries in earth science, and it's a discovery only, 50 years old or thereabouts?
Yes, well, we were in Greenland. Well, Wegener posited it back in the 1920s, but was widely discredited and hounded for the rest of his life, and yet he was incredibly prescient. And it was little expeditions like our own. It was an undergraduate expedition to East Greenland in 1965, which proved incontrovertibly that Greenland had moved 15 degrees in 30 million years, which made people like Tuzo Wilson in Toronto say, aha, the Earth is moving. Like Galileo said, eppur si muove, still it moves.
By the way, how do you find that Greenland has moved?
How do we find?
What's the nature of the evidence?
I don't want to bore you at great length, but basically, if we would drill cores of basalt, which we knew was 30 million years old, we would draw arrows on that to show where, using a sun compass, where they were aligned to the existing North Pole, magnetic North Pole. We would then take those basalts back to Oxford and look at the, under a microscope, at the little tiny crystals of hematite or magnetite and find out where the little North Poles that had been, as it were, captured as this lava solidified, as it froze. There were millions upon millions of little compasses, as it were. It cooled, it solidified, and wherever those compasses were pointing, which was to the North Pole of 30 million years ago, they froze solid. So you've got millions of these little things all pointing in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the same direction as contemporary North Pole? No, it wasn't. It was 15 degrees different, showing Greenland had moved 15 degrees to the west. I cannot tell you how exciting that was.
Yes.
When we were in that lab in Oxford and we looked, and the magnetite crystals were 15 degrees different, and we knew how long ago that had been, we said,
now who,
eppur si muove.
Whose name is associated with that discovery?
Well, a lot of people. John Dewey is now at the University of California at Davis. This guy, chap Tuzo Wilson, this wonderful man at the University of Toronto. I mean, a whole raft of people. Too many names for us to know. But no one person like there is with the genome today.
Now, how do we account for you? Well, that's what you did in 1965, did you say? Was that the year?
The 66 was when I got 66. my dismal degree.
But you went on to... be a war correspondent. You covered Watergate in Washington. You were in Kosovo. Well, good heavens, you were incarcerated by the Argentinians for 3 months during the Falklands War. You've had a rather adventurous life.
Yes, I don't know why it all happened. I mean, I came here in the 60s and spent the better part of 6 months hitchhiking all around America, fell in love with this country, vowed to come back, did indeed come back to cover the whole Watergate saga and all manner of stories. I just think I'm a picker-up of unconsidered trifles, really. I'm eternally fascinated by weird things.
You had a newspaper career, but you left that to do independent writing.
Essentially, yes. I mean, I still do the occasional piece. I covered Pol Pot's simulation. I happened to be nearby when he was being burned, and one of the London papers said, would I do something? But increasingly now, I just love getting my teeth into a subject like this.
And how many books have you done?
Well, the first 13, there was almost no point in them appearing in bookstores. I might have well taken them from my typewriter straight to the remainder table. Being in a bookstore was just a sort of gaudy irrelevance.
Really?
Because they sold so badly. But then came The Professor and the Madman, and that changed
everything. That was your breakthrough, wasn't it?
Oh, well, The River at the Center of the World, which was about the Yangtze, which was immediately before it, did reasonably well. But then when I came up with the idea for The Professor and the Madman, my publisher turned it down and said it's a magazine story, it's not a newspaper article. And then it's not a book. And then an editor found the proposal in a waste paper basket in London and said, you've got to do this in a book.
We should make clear to those who don't know the book that The Professor is the man who essentially conceived and put together the Oxford English Dictionary, and the Madman is...
He's a chap, an American called W.C. Minor, who was very sadly insane, and who murdered someone in London and was incarcerated for most of the rest of his life in a lunatic asylum.
But he's sending entries for the OED.
He was the principal contributor to the OED. Without W.C. Minor, the OED would be a very different thing than it is.
And they got to know one another.
They became firm friends, despite the one being a stern Calvinist lexicographer, the other a convicted American murderer, and united by this passion for the English language, they became the firmest of friends. I'm actually just writing about it all over again for a new book.
Oh.
In fact, that's when I'm next back in Chicago in November to talk about, it's going to be called The Meaning of Everything, which is about, and may I share with you the one witticism that I asked one of the lexicographers at the OED, they're all very, very serious people, was there any wit in the OED? And he said, only inadvertently. And I said, what wit is it? He said, well, look up the second sense of the rather obscure noun abbreviator, which I did. And the definition in the OED for the word abbreviator is a junior Vatican official whose duties include drawing up the Pope's briefs.
Double
double entendre, except I have to say that the use of the word briefs for what you and I know briefs to be did not come about till the 1930s. That definition was written in 1880. James Murray was completely innocent, and it wasn't a double entendre, but it reads as one today.
Linguistic reality readjusted itself to accommodate to that definition.
Yes, well, possibly, yes.
We have reached the end of the available time. The book we've been drawing from by Simon Winchester. And we trust we'll have him here again when he's in town talking about the new book concerning the making of the OED. But the present book is Krakatoa, The Day the World Exploded, August 27, 1883. HarperCollins are the publishers. We won't be here tomorrow or Friday. That is, we may be by tape after the ball game. But if not, we'll be here in full force on Thursday night for our meeting with and our discussion with the author of the new biography of Sergei Khrushchev. On to that, Nikita Khrushchev, Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev. And we'll be with you then on Thursday doing that. Until then, a cordial good night to all.